This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Each week we talk with someone who is making a positive difference in applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Dr. Robert Howell, whose new book, Investing in People and the Planet, is published by...
myself. I'm a self-publisher. And it's available through Quaker Books. So if you go to the Quaker website, and you'll be able to find it there. But if you have some problems, my email is rhowellnz@gmail.com, and I'll be able to get you the book.
So let's take a few steps back. Where'd you grow up?
Napier.
What was it like growing up in Napier at the time?
Well, it was very interesting because... I went to Victoria University and spent 10 years in Wellington, then came back to Napier as city manager. And when you come back as city manager, you see the city through different eyes. Did you know that the largest stormwater pumps in the country are in Napier? And the reason for that is that the earthquake, my parents went through the 1931 earthquake, so that was part of my upbringing. But it never did its job properly. It only raised the land so far, and the water didn't drain. So coming back and looking at it in different eyes was great. It was. I was looking back now. My father wasn't rich, but we were well looked after. We had a reasonably good upbringing. It was Pākehā orientated, didn't have much to do with Māori, but it was a reasonable education and some happy times.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Originally I looked at being a minister of religion, but I went to university and I guess that was part of my growing up, and I didn't become a minister of religion.
So what did you do at university?
Well, I did philosophy initially. I've got a master's in philosophy. And then I went, I had 2 years in broadcasting and then went into the health sector. And eventually I joined a small innovative unit that was headed up by management consultants to improve the efficiency of Wellington Hospital. And I didn't know anything about management, and even less about hospitals. I learned a hell of a lot.
I'll just take another step back. Why philosophy?
Well, it was part of the religious stuff. But when I look back now, I guess I had a skill and an innate desire to sort out the basic fundamental questions in life. I wouldn't have put it like that, but they interested me. So that was part of the philosophy stuff.
Did you know at the time what you were going to do with it, or didn't it matter?
No, because I was growing up and searching, and the thing about philosophy, that as I got it, was that it gave you the intellectual tools to be able to examine the fundamental issues. It's not the only discipline, of course, but it's one of them.
So was it a shock going from answering the fundamental questions of life to improving the efficiency of the health service? That sounds quite sort of operational.
Well, I guess the searching has not stopped. And I've always tried to be open to new initiatives. And I've had, and I didn't grow up all, just by doing a philosophy, you don't grow up. In actual fact, when I got married, been married with my wife for about 5 years, and she had education and psych training, and she decided that to keep those alive, when our kids came along, she'd do marriage guidance training. And her doing that led me to do that training. And I would say part of my growing up was learning those basic skills to be able to relate to people and start talking about my feelings and talking about feelings with others. And those skills were just as important as the intellectual skills that I developed with philosophy.
So what have you been searching for?
That's a very good question. I guess I was wanting to, because I was brought up in an evangelical religious framework. Questions like, you know, is there a God, and if there is, what is a God? And I decided that the personal so-called being that manipulates the world from outside and is really that's part of a myth storytelling that's relevant for some people but not for me. And then I guess I wanted to just start learning about some of the ways in which the world worked.
And if there is a God, what's he playing out with all the wars and climate change?
Well, I don't use the term God now.
Okay. Okay.
My wife was a Quaker, okay, and over 30 years, osmosis took place. and Quakers, one of the attraction of Quakers is that they don't have a creedal affirmation. They have a lot of emphasis on a personal experience. The Māori word for the Quakers in New Zealand is Te Tahi Tuawere, which means the group that stands shaking, blown around, buffeted by the wind of the spirit. And I prefer to talk about spirit rather than God, because God, the term God, has been so badly abused. When George Bush says that God led him to go into the Middle East, then I don't want to use that term. So I talk about spirit in terms of certain sorts of experiences that have profound impact on one in terms of thinking about the purpose of life, the mysteries of life, the beauty of life, and those sorts of experiences. Where you feel one with the world. Doesn't happen all the time, of course, but
how do you mix that with doing the job, whatever it is? You know, eventually you found yourself back in Napier running the city. Is it always in your head? Is it something you do at home? What's the relationship there?
Can I just go back to the hospital? I mean, I saw that my role in the hospital was to help, to work at a practical level, helping people use taxpayer resources more efficiently. I saw that if I could get a better buck for the way in which the system was run, then that was a good contribution to society. So I was brought in initially in Napier by a reforming mayor to improve it. We did. So I was seeing my work, and during that I developed skills and had training in my PhD was really in how do you measure the community's health for planning purposes, which led me to use my philosophical skills to say what is health. I rejected the medical model So I developed a different kind of model for health for those purposes. So it was using the philosophical skills, but then embedding it within a strategic planning framework. And I guess I brought to my work as a change agent, as a CEO, as a consultant, as a university teacher, I brought a strategic perspective. So the strategies, strategic processes and how we design and run our organisations, that's what I developed.
Did you do your PhD while you were working?
I was able to... The Wellington Hospital Board gave me 1 week. One day a week to while I was working to work on the PhD, and I did that for 2 years. I basically read. And then I got a Medical Research Council grant to go to the States for 2.5 months and Britain for 2 months. That was full-time. And then I came back in the light of all that experience and questioning and so forth and did all the field work and wrote up, and that was on a Medical Research Council grant. The how I got into the council was that there was no immediate niche for me to get back into the health area, and I was home in Napier, and a new mayor had been elected, and he didn't want a town clerk, he wanted a city manager, and he wanted somebody who could reform the council, and that was part of my task. Very difficult, the council was very divided, but we managed to make some significant changes.
I'm just looking through your CV over the following 10 years, and there's a whole pile of stuff in there. You've certainly kept yourself busy and working a whole lot of different areas.
Yes, at times it became very awkward. In part, my wife was what I would call a social entrepreneur. So she developed a language school in Napier. She was one of the early pioneers in that area, brought Japanese students. And I met some Japanese people, and when I left the council, I developed an agricultural college. College is a bit grandiose. It was really a cross between a community high school and a college. But it brought, we had one-year courses amongst others, and brought Japanese students out, gave them 3 months English training, and then put them on farms, dairy farms, beef and sheep, horticulture and so on, practical experience stuff. And then at the same time, I started links with Massey University, and they wanted me to run a course in local government, and I linked up with Massey people, and we did a lot of reviews of that local government process 5 years down the track. One of the research processes, research projects I did was to look at the way in which governance had been changed, because part of the problem of running local authorities is that I was in charge of I forget how many staff we had now, about 1,000 or something like that, a budget of about 50 million. The majority of the councillors were in businesses that had no more than 2 or 3 staff. So the processes of organising a larger operation were quite difficult for them, and they wanted to get hands-on. And really the whole question of the role of a council or a board and its relationship with the stakeholders was the subject of a study that I did to see whether the reforms in the 80s had made a difference. Short answer, they hadn't. But during that process, I identified a model by Carver, an American researcher, and then I used that subsequently to teach and consult in that whole governance area.
When you're working in the council, or in fact any organisation, any business that's operating at that kind of scale in the tens of millions of dollars, is it possible to apply those sort of principles that we touched on before, the beauty of life and the peacemaking and all that sort of stuff? Does it work in that kind of organisation?
I actually, when I first went to the council, I used more of my marriage guidance stuff because the council was divided. So it involved a lot of listening, okay? And then putting in the systems to be able to make the organisation more efficient. And I think that, I see strategy and organisational design, if it's done properly, is good problem solving. What you're doing is avoiding the fisty-fist conflicts, and you're providing a method of resolving those issues in a non-violent kind of way. So strategy, for me, is part of a non-violent process, if you like.
Eventually you found yourself in Auckland working for doing various governance things, and it was about that time you started getting interested in responsible investment?
What happened was that I wanted to get a consulting job with some Anglican trusts about governance, okay? And their basic job was investing. It was a bit of a mess. There were a lot of them. I never got the job. But then I got invited to be the Quaker representative on the equivalent of the National Council of Churches. So I persuaded them to set up a committee to look at church investments as good background for me to do more consulting in this, a selfish as well as a altruistic motive. And eventually that morphed into a looking at investment in not just a religious way but a more fundamental way for everybody. And I set up the Council for Social Responsible Investment that was open to everybody. If I could sort of take you down where that led me, was that I then began to say, what are the kind of measures that one should look for to know that a company is being responsible to the environment as well as to humans, the human earth as well as the human-human relationship? And to cut a long story short, that took me to two think tanks. One was the Quaker Institute for the Future, which was set up in North America by Quakers, and the other one was Sustainable Aotearoa New Zealand, based in New Zealand, of course. The beauty of those is that they were multidisciplinary. There were scientists, economists, lawyers, a real mix of people. And I learnt a hell of a lot from those groups. The first one was the state of the earth for sustaining human life is pretty fragile. Very, very threatened, far more than I ever had appreciated. Secondly, a significant reason why that is the case is because of our economic models and our financial models. And the third thing was that that's related to our ethics. And that was what really interested me in going back to my original philosophy. So I went back and did some philosophical stuff and started reading stuff that I had sort of touched on about 40 years ago, but then read quite widely in that area. And what I was able to do was bring a public policy perspective as well as a integrating perspective. So as part of trying to get a handle on all of this, it was a very fertile time for me. I've done a what I call a wiring diagram. It's on a one page, and on the left hand top are the three or four ethical traditions like Aristotle, utilitarianism, the social contract, and mapped out how over in Aristotle's time, over centuries, how they have moved from just being concerned about human-human relationships to include a human-earth relationship. So all the significant philosophers today have extended those traditions to deal with those issues. So that was at the top. In the middle was all the economic models and how they have changed. And at the bottom was the science and the major scientific discoveries. And then I had little dots related to major changes that occurred. And I found that was my way of making sense. Now, I've given that as a lecture for over 50-plus times. And people have found it very helpful. So what I was able to do was provide an overview, an integrating perspective to look at how the science and the economics and the ethical stuff had changed in significant ways, but there were gaps, you see. I mean, the economic model that we have today is still based on crude utilitarianism, and they haven't made the changes. The other thing that it helped me to do was really then start to think, well, what does this have for investment? And then that took me back to the journey that this book is about, because this book is, even though I wrote it in a month and sort of corrected it in about 2 months with sending it out and proofreading and all that stuff that you'll know about, it's really a summation of what I've learned over the last 10 to 15 years and how about 90% of the world's investments are unethical. Made some surprising discoveries. Did you know, for example, that while the New Zealand government was taking on the French government and the American government and the world generally over 3 decades about nuclear weapons, during all that time, government investments were invested in the nuclear weapons industry?
No.
No, a lot of people don't. So part of what I'm on about is saying to people, there is a connection between the way you invest and your values. And so what I've tried to do is make that connection and to say it's really important as individuals that we make that connection. And here are the sort of tools to be able to put your values into practice as a taxpayer and as an individual investor. How do you select the KiwiSaver fund that is consistent with your values? How do you sort out which fund, managed fund or insurance company or bank, how do you sort out whether they are actually caring for people on the planet? How do you get through all the PR hype in simple terms and start to use the power that you as an individual have to be able to make those changes? That's what the book's about.
You said 90% of the world's investments are unethical.
Managed funds.
Is that...
And sovereign wealth funds.
Is unethical there mean done without consideration of ethics, or does it mean somehow bad? Or is it bad by definition if you're not thinking about it?
The questions, if you go through my diagram, okay, that gives you all the sophisticated discussion. But at the bottom line, the very bottom line, for me personally, what it means is one needs to develop a principle for dealing with people, the human-human ethic. And then you need to deal with the human-earth ethic. So for me, the human-human ethic is based on fairness. That's the term that I would use. Other people use similar sorts of terms. They've got similar sort of mileage. But just in simple terms, that's the core concept. In terms of the human earth, I would say rather than exploiting the earth for human utility, one should respect the earth. Now, there are other terms. Schweitzer uses reverence for life. There are lots of other terms. But for me, respect. So I want to then say of the companies that the New Zealand Superannuation Fund invests in, and ACC, and KiwiSavers, the KiwiSaver funds and my bank and my insurance company, the universities, the councils. Do they meet those principles? Do they actually, are they based on fairness? Do they actually abuse people in a fundamental kind of way? And I'll give you an example with Nucor in just a moment. And do they actually respect the earth so that humans can live within the capacity of the earth to support life, human life? Now, at the moment, the way we run our investments and the way we run our business models and the way we run our economic models, we are not living within the capacity to for the earth to support human life. Those are the two fundamental principles. And I then have a series of more detailed questions that enable one to tease out whether that's the case. And just to give you an example of Nucor, Nucor is the largest steel company in the United States. A number of years ago, it got pig iron from Brazil. That pig iron was produced using charcoal that was came from the forests of Brazil from slave labour. A group of people in the United States, including, but there are others, the Interfaith Centre for Corporate Responsibility, which is a grouping of Protestant, Catholic and Jewish investors with about $100 billion under investment. They are the world's best shareholder activists. So they went along to Nucor, to its management and its AGM, and they put resolutions to say to Nucor they would adopt as a policy not to buy any pig iron from Brazil unless any iron from Brazil that was produced with slave labour. And they also wanted Nucor to fund two groups in Brazil to independently verify that Nucor was doing what it promised to do. Well, that took 3 years of negotiations. So here is a company, Nucor, that is using slave labour for steel. That doesn't meet the human-human perspective. That's not fair. Okay, so that's one example. Plenty of examples in the human-earth relationship. All the Australian banks, all the big Australian banks are invested in coal, fossil fuels. Okay, coal, if we don't get out of coal, if the world doesn't quickly get out of the use of coal, we are into a 2 degrees Celsius plus warming. Now that's got major implications, and that's likely to happen at the moment. That's likely to happen the decade 2030, starting 2030. That's only, it's less than 15 years away. So from a New Zealand point of view, a 2 degree warming. We have just had recently fires in Christchurch. In Auckland, we've had heavy downpours, which have caused quite considerable infrastructural damage. In the north of Auckland, we've had a 9-month drought. Okay, you get a 2 degree Celsius warming, you're going to have more droughts, more floods, more heavy rainfall, and you're going to have it more often. That's going to have a major impact on New Zealanders. It's going to have a major impact on our economies. Now, that's just New Zealand. You look at what's the impact in terms of Australia and some of our major partners where we sell our milk and various other things to. It will have a major effect in China. So there are a number of companies that are simply not preparing us to be able to deal with this sort of scenario. So there's an example of how you can apply the principles in terms of human earth, human. Okay.
One of my favourite definitions of sustainability is ethics expanded in space and time. And what I do in some of my teaching is expand on the trolley problem, the train racing down the track and it's going to kill three people, but you can save them, but it's still going to kill one. Mm-hmm. And you can do students' heads in quite quickly about getting them to the edge of utilitarian ethics. Mm-hmm. What happens if one of them's your grandmother, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And my question is, well, if you had a third alternative, and you could divert it into a forest, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just a quote, empty forest, then the forest. But what if it's got the last two remaining orangutan in it? You've got a much deeper understanding of this than me.
Okay, these are lifeboat choices, mm-hmm. aren't they? Look, when you're in the middle of a war, it's really difficult for these choices. What I would prefer to do is to slow the train down in the first place. Okay, so what? This is the strategic perspective that I bring. Let me quote you an example of Shell, not my favourite company, but in the late 1960s, early 70s, they set up a strategic planning unit. Now, at that time, Shell was saying, strategically, we look at the oil that was supplied last year and sold, and we add 2%. And you had a gradual rise in the graph over a decade or so. And the strategic planning unit was asked to look at some of the strategic options. And they said, well, instead of 2%, what if it's 20%? What would we do as a company if all of a sudden the oil increased by 20%? And then they started to say, well, this is the things that we could do. Okay. Then the Arabs came along and did exactly that. Okay. And Shell was very well placed because they'd done the thinking beforehand to be able to deal with how to respond to that. Except the shipbuilding section, the tanker section of Shell. They didn't want any to do with this strategic planning stuff, right? And so when the Arabs increased the price of oil, they kept building ships until they had so many ships that they didn't know what to do with them. They kept falling over them and et cetera, et cetera. And then they suddenly realized that, in fact, the strategic stuff was actually relevant. So what I want to say is there are certain things that I can't do. I think the time for averting significant climate warming, the easy options have gone. I just think we are faced with some pretty very difficult places, and people will die, okay? And ecologies will die, animals will die. Nothing I can do about that. But what I can do is start to encourage fellow colleagues, people like yourselves and people listening to this radio, to say, let's start preparing options for how we're going to deal with adapting to these situations. And one of the advantages of the Shell analogy is that once you've done that, you can actually read the signs. The Shell people in the tanker division weren't reading the signs. And there are people in New Zealand, including our government, who bemoan the fact that another 100-year flood has arrived since the last 5 years, and another one's going to come, and they're not reading the signs. How many fires do you need? How many droughts do you need? Well, if you start thinking about the scenarios that the science are talking about, then you do read the signs, and then you're in a much better position to start preparing options. Some of those options are going to be very difficult. Can I give you another train analogy?
Mm-hmm.
I'm very critical of the SRI industry, socially responsible industry, because I think that they have been captured by a model that's not valid. And that's the United Nations principles of responsible investment. It's not a valid definition. A whole variety of reasons I can give for this, but I'll leave those to one side. You can come back to me if you want to. What that means is that the New Zealand Super Fund claims in its annual report, we are a responsible investment because we have signed up to the UNPRI, but they're invested in ExxonMobil, and they're invested in Rio Tinto and a whole series of other companies that are really notorious for the way they treat people and the way they treat the planet. And so the UNPRI is seeming to do something. It's what I would say walking southward on a northbound train. It gives you the impression that you're going in one direction when you're actually going in another direction. That's my another train story.
Okay, I'm going to have another one then. And to further extend the space and time thing, if we could have an alternative track where we put the train onto some sort of space-time loop, mm-hmm. that it disappears for 10 years, but then it's going to come back in 10 years, and instead of two or three people, it's going to kill off some large number, 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do? And it really does my head in to think that I'm the person that's supposed to know this stuff, and my gut reaction is to go for that one. Why are we so bad at the ethics of the future?
If you've got 2 hours for me to go through the psychology of decision-making, I might answer that. Let me give you a couple of suggestions. I think that if you're a young family with kids, you're worried about where you're going to live, how you're going to pay for your house, how you're going to get a job that's going to give you enough, etc., etc. You get focused on the immediate short term. Okay? It's very difficult to start making significant changes out of that. So you get bound up into the business as usual model. Okay, so that's one thing. The second thing is that if you want to move away from the business as usual model in the company, I've bought an electric car. I'm getting solar panels in the house, getting more water tanks because we've just shifted where we are in Auckland. But there are certain things that if I really wanted to be purely sustainable, I'd find it very, very difficult, because how do I look after somebody who's sick, who needs an ambulance? The ambulance at the moment uses petrol. Okay? So what do I do? Do I deny using an ambulance to take somebody to the hospital because it's using petrol? So you're faced with really difficult choices. So what you do, I like the analogy of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan came along and saw somebody lying in the gutter. The Good Samaritan was a Jew. The guy lying in the gutter was not. He helped him, bound up his wounds and took him to an inn. Didn't bother to save the world. He just wanted to help that guy. So my suggestion, my focus is where you have the opportunities to help people in small little ways, do it. Because if everybody did that, then the world would change. And that's why I come back to investments. People say, oh, it's too hard. I don't understand finance, etc., etc. But in my book, I try and spell out in very simple terms what we, in very simple ways, can do to use our little money to actually start making some changes. And when you do that with others, it's very powerful. Not sure whether that answers your question. Does it? Come back.
I think so. What it leads me to is a question of, can you live ethically when, as you've just described, we almost can't live sustainably?
Well, the short answer is no. Okay. The society that we live in at the moment, the food we eat, for example, if we're really honest with ourselves, is the food sustainable? Do we get tomatoes from Italy? If you go into the supermarket and then go through as much as you can, because the labelling's pretty terrible, you know, made in New Zealand from New Zealand and imported stuff. But if you really did an accurate assessment of our food and how sustainable it was, it wouldn't be. Right? Well, one of the alternatives is to actually grow your own food. But if you're a mum with three or four kids, there is some food that you can grow. You can grow your herbs and have it, get a little garden going. But it's sometimes quite difficult to be completely organic, and you can pay a bit more for organic food, but your choices are limited, you know. So you do what you can and try and persuade. So that's why I say go and start using your money, because that's a way of helping people to make the changes.
So if it's so very difficult for us to live sustainably and ethically, is there a pathway to a positive future?
I think that we all make mistakes. Aristotle talks about ethics in the terms of being an apprentice, which I like. That is that you have to learn how to be good, and it takes a while, and there are some things that you need to learn at 70 that you can't learn when you're 20. So it's an ongoing process, and there's some very difficult choices on the way that don't make it easy. My wife died from cancer 2 years ago. I thought that I knew how to handle grief because I'd been trained as a marriage guidance counsellor, see. Well, I didn't. So that was a really difficult learning time for me, okay. The year she died, there were some good times, but some really difficult times. The year after, trying to learn to live with her, we were a close, intimate partner for 45 years. Ratchet here, terrible. And it really posed for me some very difficult personal moral questions about should I have a new partner, when, how. My family didn't want that. A number of people said, don't do it, Robert, don't do it. Yet losing that companionship was just terrible. So how did I prepare myself for that? Well, I thought I had, but I hadn't. So life throws at you stuff that you don't know, okay? So you're going to make mistakes. That's life. What you have to do is try and be as resilient and capable. Use your strengths as you can.
Do you have a word that you use to describe what we need to be doing? Do you use sustainable? Do you just use resilient?
I think sustainability has lost its credibility like God. It's become a PR term. Sustainable companies. Well, I want to know what they're actually doing. I want to know what their ecological footprint is. I want to know what their policies are in terms of human earth ethics. I want to know what they're doing by way of planning for a world that's going to have 2 degrees plus Celsius warming. Those are my three questions of the companies. You know, when I go to annual reports and when I talk with banks and so forth, my questions are, where are your policies dealing with the human-earth relationships and the policies and your codes of conduct and so forth? Secondly, where's your ecological footprint? Are you actually measuring that? It's not just CO2 or CO2 equivalent. It's water use and effect on species and so on. And thirdly, what are you doing to prepare for a 2 degrees Celsius plus warming world? So for me, that's sustainability, I guess, is, and resilience are part of those questions and those stories.
We're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. How would you describe your superpower? What are you bringing to the good fight?
I'm not sure I like the term a hero. Okay. What I would want to say is that if people can learn from the journey that I've had, then I'm happy to talk about it. I think that the experiences and the stories and the learnings that I've had are not well known. Not many people know about the government investing in nuclear weapons industries while they were opposing the French and the Americans. And this, so I'm wanting to make those stories made known. I'm wanting to alert people in public office and organising organisations, both public and private, that the world is really facing some very, very serious challenges. The thing that I brought to the think tanks, which composed of scientists and economists and so forth, was a public policy perspective. An ethical perspective. I asked questions like, what are your values? And how do you integrate that into the dialogue? So that's what I bring, the knowledge of 15 or so years, a strategic perspective, talking about that journey. If that's of value to people, then I'd be happy to be known for that.
Okay, I've got four more questions and four more minutes. So, minute per question. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes.
You talked about shareholder activists. Is that the...
That's part of it, yeah.
What's the activist role you have?
Well, at the moment, I'm working with 350.org, amongst others. Other organisations, and I've been in dialogue with the Auckland Council about its investments. I've taken them to the Ombudsman, and I'm providing examples and strategies and things to 350. So,
have you always been an activist?
No, because when I go back to the start of my career, and what I felt is that I could best contribute to society if I worked within organisations to help them be more strategic and efficient. Getting better value for money, if you got better value for money, then that was a major contribution to society. So I've done and tried to do a lot of working with people. One story I haven't told you about is that in the 90s, I initiated a project to... work with the Indonesian police, bringing non-violent training to the police in Indonesia. And that was working with the New Zealand government to get funding and working with a group in Yogyakarta. So it was working within the system. But I've got to the stage now where I think a more public activist advocacy role is necessary.
Okay, we're now down to 30 seconds per question. What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
There are times where I get pissed off and angry. At times, I want to finish. There's a bit of stubbornness about me. I don't like people getting away with hypocrisy and stuff. And also, I've got three grandchildren.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you like to have happen?
That's a difficult one. I really would like the government to face up to these issues of climate warming and the fact that our economic model is bust, and start doing a proper dialogue and regulating. I call New Zealand government and New Zealand the Volkswagen of the Pacific because they're cheating. I'd like them to be honest and engage with not just the money people in New Zealand, but everybody.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
read my book to enable to be enabled to ask the right questions about which bank you choose, which Kiwi fund you want, where do you want to put your money, and join with others to be able to make those changes.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lands Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelands.org. On sustainablelens.org, we are building up a searchable archive with of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we're trying to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens, even if he doesn't call it that anymore, was that of Dr. Robert Howell, whose new book, Investing in People and the Planet, is available from him, and we'll put a link to that on the website. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.